Greetings, my friends, and welcome to The Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. What makes us genuinely safe? Our guest, Christopher Dickey, shows us the many faces of security. He's an award-winning Newsweek bureau chief and reporter. He's covered many of the world's hotspots focused on counterterrorism and espionage. And he is author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. Mr. Dickey reports there's compelling evidence that the United States' greatest defense against criminal acts of terror is the spirit of the country itself. Don't confuse this with being naive, he insists.
That has to do with the spirit of the country. I mean, you don't want to sound kind of airy-fairy talking about this, because you've got bad guys with guns and bombs and doing all kinds of crazy stuff out there. But the truth is, the best thing you've got going for you is the community that rejects those kinds of actions. And, you know, in telling the history of terrorism in New York, there are a lot of examples before 9/11, too. There was one very conspicuous one when 1997, where two Palestinians decided they were going to blow themselves up on the B train under the East River, and they were living in a shack on Park Slope in Brooklyn, and they had a couple of flatmates. And one of them was a young Egyptian guy who had won the lottery for a green card. And all he wanted to do was build his future in America. They showed him the bomb, and he went out on the street looking for a cop. It took him 7 or 8 hours trying to convince the police there was a problem here. But the bottom line is, he believed in the dream. And he did not want to be implicated in this act of terror. And he stopped it from happening. And if he had not done what he did, then those two guys, one of them would have blown himself up, and when the rescue workers came, the second one would have blown himself up, and you would have had a situation that was a hell of a lot more grotesque and bloody and horrible than even what happened in London in 2005.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek magazine's Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor, having served as their Cairo bureau chief. Previously, he was bureau chief for the Washington Post, covering Central America. His Newsweek online column, Shadowland, is a weekly update on counterterrorism, espionage, and the Middle East. Mr. Dickey's growing number of books now includes Securing the City. Bill Russell and I were drawn to Mr. Dickey's sophisticated sense of what makes for genuine security and the unrelenting tensions between protecting our civil liberties and keeping the bad guys at bay. His discoveries and insights whetted our appetites for this conversation. Christopher Dickey, I absolutely love words. And when coming across Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the New York Public, the New York Police Department, NYPD.
New York Public Library, it's a great story.
I was headed that way.
It's intelligence, you know.
The idea of security was one of those word things that I thought, well, let's see, where is he going with this? Oh, wait a minute, it's Christopher Dickey. He probably is going to tell me about security in ways that are not necessarily the New York Public Library. But the idea of security is a wonderful idea that has many facets, that's more than just shoot 'em ups. Yes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was what interested me, is how do you make people in a city, in any urban environment, but New York maybe being the most challenging urban environment in the world, how do you make them feel safe as they walk the street? How do you make them feel confident that they're not going to be mugged or blown up or vaporized in today's world? And how do you make them not only feel confident, but how do you actually make them safer? So it's not just a question of illusion and delusion, but a reality of a world that's safer for them. And that was essentially the question that I tried to address in writing the book. The prologue is all about that.
Amory Lovins, who founded the Rocky Mountain Institute and is one of the world's great energy experts, he calls himself a recovering physicist, I think was the first one who really clued me into this. And this was, I think, before 9/11, and people started saying, ooh, security. But he was very clear that until we start getting some fundamentals in our infrastructure and in our society, more largely writ, until we start really thinking carefully about that, that we won't be secure. He then goes into how we need to think about energy and how we need to move into a different kind of a future than simply being locked into, in this case, oil or nukes. So the notion of
helping people think in a broad way, again, comes to this. And then it reads like a novel. How'd you do that?
I'm just an incredibly talented writer.
That must be it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've written 6 books, and I've tried to write probably 12. And the only books that I can finish are the ones where I start writing them, and the storytelling becomes compelling enough so that I don't want to put them down. And when that's happening, I guess it works. I mean, people seem to respond as if it does.
Well, it gets better and better and better as you go forward.
It's also an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
You don't even have to create the characters. They sort of create themselves.
No, they're great characters. I mean, I had met Ray Kelly back in about 2000. I was working on a story about the links between the organized crime and cigarette manufacturers all around the world. And just a parenthesis, it was a hard story to get published because nobody is surprised by anything that the cigarette companies do. If you said they were injecting infants with nicotine, people would go, yeah, it sounds like the cigarette companies. So anyway, when I was working on that, he was at Customs. He was at the Treasury Department, having previously been the police commissioner in New York. And we just hit it off because he's got an extraordinary personality. For one thing, he has a personality of someone who, through his own charisma, makes you feel secure.
Huh.
He has that effect on people. He has a kind of a confidence and a competence that's very reassuring. But he's also interested in just lots of different things. So, in the course of our conversation, he said, "You live in Paris?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I love to get over to Paris. I get over there, my wife and I get over there as much as we possibly can." And when he left Treasury and went into the private sector working with Bear Stearns in their security department, which would normally be a time when you'd lose contact with somebody like him. We didn't lose contact because he was coming back and forth to Paris. So when I saw what he had done with the NYPD over time, as I had the chance to start to write about the issue of terrorism, I got back in touch with Kelly to see if he would cooperate with me. And eventually he did. And now it's very interesting to see how people respond, when he talks about the book, which he's done on a couple of occasions, that he still projects that confidence. New Yorkers really love this guy for precisely that sense of security that he imparts. Of course, the other guy who's just absolutely riveting is David Cohen, who was the much-hated head of the clandestine services of the CIA, whose career had been one in which he was always the outsider on the inside of the agency. The agency was crumbling, and his career was flourishing until he took over the clandestine services in the mid-1990s. And among his failed projects was the effort to overthrow Saddam Hussein that was conducted by the Clinton administration. So that when he finally left the agency, first he was assigned to New York as a way to phase out, and then he went into the private sector in 2000. I think he must have looked back on his career without much gratification or pleasure. And the story of how these two guys came back into their careers in 2002, Kelly and then Kelly hiring Cohen, and reinvented the work that they did, police work and intelligence work, and the way those fit together, seemed to me a really compelling story, and they are great characters.
You talk about granularity and context, and I think we would like to come back to
that,
it seems to me that's just right at the heart of what this is all about.
And it will be when we come back, as he takes a deep breath, getting ready for the next segment. Be with us. We'll return in a moment. We're delighted to be with Christopher Dickey, who has written Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD, and lots of other things. You've been working with Newsweek for many years. You have gone all over the world thinking about, looking, reporting on, helping us think about terrorism in a wider scale and lots of other issues. Bill, you were saying granularity and context, which sounds pretty removed from this blockbuster story you're telling.
Well, it's all about people. I mean, the key to fighting terrorism is to have a lot of very good human intelligence. Human intelligence, human intelligence, human intelligence is sort of like location, location, location.
Yeah.
That's where you have to focus your resources. Now, how do you get good human intelligence? Do you waterboard people? Do you torture them? Do you put them in Abu Ghraib? Do you put them in Guantanamo? Sometimes that might give you some. Sometimes that might give you some intelligence, but it's often going to be very unreliable intelligence.
And it's very illegal.
Well, there's that.
And is it immoral?
Well, there's that. But let's not be picky about these things.
It's counterproductive.
Let's just talk about the functionality of it. What you really want to do, if you're going to have really effective human intelligence, you've got to be penetrating organizations. You've got to be liaising with communities. You've got to be working with people. And what is so striking about the NYPD is the way they took the diversity of New York, which I think a lot of people in the United States would look at and say, what a nightmare. 40% of the population of New York City was not born in the United States of America. You know, that's like, they're not from around here, are they? And they take that and they make it work for them. Because the NYPD is a great entry-level position. Police have always been entry-level positions, police jobs. For immigrants, whether they were Irish or Italian or German or Polish, for more than a century. So that's still true. And what they did, one of the first things they did when Kelly came back in and brought in Cohen, was to say, I wonder how many people we've got on the force already who speak foreign languages. And they ask for volunteers, tell them, do you speak a foreign language? And of course, they're not going to just take their word for it. They test them, send them off to Berlitz to be tested. And they came back with about 700 people in the NYPD who spoke languages directly relevant to the fight against terrorism.
Things like?
Spoke them as native languages. Arabic in many dialects. Persian. Dari. Pashtun.
Urdu.
Bengali. You name it. They had it.
And, Urdu, Farsi.
Yeah. Persian. Yeah, exactly. They just go... They had all these, not linguists, this is an important distinction, not translators. They had all these cops who spoke these languages as their native language.
In startling contrast to the CIA and the FBI.
In stunning contrast to the CIA
and the State Department.
And the FBI and the State Department. In stunning contrast to any federal government job that requires a high-level security clearance. And most of those do. If you want to be an FBI agent, if you want to be a CIA operative, you have to get those high-level clearances, which means going through a process that basically dates to the Cold War. A good friend of mine is in military intelligence, very close friend, and you know, he says, look, the security clearance process is insane. You know, if you were born outside the country, they can't do a background check on you. Let's say you were born in Karachi. You know the back streets of Karachi. Now, that's exactly the kind of person you want in your intelligence business, right? But how are the guys doing the background check going to go knock on the door of people in Karachi? Gee, did you know this guy when he was in the madrasa when he was 6 years old? You think he was a radical? No, you can't do that. You can't. Functionally, you can't do it, which means none of those guys from Karachi are ever going to be FBI agents. Or CIA agents.
It's a tremendous loss.
It is a tremendous loss, but not a loss to the NYPD, which is just the point. The NYPD says, look, we'll polygraph these guys, we'll do background checks on them, we'll obviously keep an eye on them, but we'll work with them and we'll bring them into the system.
And they've already been vetted to be cops.
And they've already been vetted to be cops, but that's not like, as any one of the feds will tell you, it's not like being vetted to be a FBI agent.
One of the three-letter guys.
One of the three-letter guys, exactly. which is what the NYPD calls it is funny, you know, when they said that to me the first time, three-letter guys, I was like, oh yeah, they're all three, CIA, FBI, DEA, ICE, it's all three-letter guys.
White House.
Yeah, why not?
Well, National Security Council.
Yeah, NSC, yeah. So that made a huge difference, that they didn't have to vet these guys in that federal government process. And so they had all of a sudden all these resources to do what with them? Well, some of them work the web in the intelligence division. They work the chat rooms. So, and you know, there are filters that the bad guys will use in the chat rooms, where they'll say, you know, I just went by that mosque that was torn down last week, last year in Karachi, And that's if you don't know that that mosque is actually still standing in Karachi, you're not going to get to the next level in that chat room. But since the NYPD's guys do know that, they can say, what the heck, what are you talking about? So,
because they were just back for the wedding.
Because they were just back for the, well, actually, that was a classic case. When I was doing one of the chapters in the book, is a narrative of the sort of last days before New Year's Eve, 2007, when Benazir Bhutto has been murdered. And there's a question of how the police are going to react to this. Now, The police in New York. And the NYPD does have people stationed in a lot of places, but they don't have any stationed in Pakistan. I asked them about that, and they said, well, you know, it worked out okay because one of our guys from the counterterrorism division was back there for a family wedding anyway. So it's that kind of intimacy which is the key to the intelligence gathering in the NYPD and the key to its eventual ability to, as Cohen likes to say, trade intelligence, not share intelligence. He says there's no such thing as sharing intelligence, only trading.
Which New Yorkers are probably pretty good at.
Yeah, New Yorkers are probably pretty good at. And the federal government is really not used to from a local police force.
They don't understand that. This is almost parenthetical, but you quote somebody early on saying that, you know, talking about interrogation techniques and enhanced so-called interrogation techniques. Quote somebody as saying, if you can get the subject laughing with you, you will get a statement every time. Which is, I mean, there are a lot of things in this book that are counterintuitive. That one's high on the list. And it tells us a great deal about the kinds of human intelligence you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was before the Age of Terror. That was Jack Maple, who was one of the men responsible, really, for the radical changes in crime fighting that took place in the NYPD in the early and mid-1990s when Kelly was out of the picture. And Maple, you know, was a real straight shooter. And he says, it's all about building complicity, building rapport with the subject. He said, you know, if you can make them laugh, that's the key. But he said, I'll get down on my knees and pray to God with the subject if he'll talk to me, if he'll give it to me, if he'll give up what I want him to give up. And most people want to talk. The idea that these hardened terrorists don't want to talk, nah. It's fascinating. And, you know, in the book, there's a lot of sort of history of terrorism. And I wanted, since I was writing this, to put together pieces that I hadn't seen anybody else put together before. And I was very interested in why Al-Qaeda failed in its attempt to have a second wave of attacks, which it certainly had wanted to do. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 9/11, had wanted these second waves to take place. And it was in the effort to stop that we had all this waterboarding going on at the black sites. And it's amazing how much the waterboarders did not understand about the people they were waterboarding. Even if we just take it as a given that they only did the three that they've admitted to doing. Abu Zubaydah, the first one they caught, was a sort of a concierge at the Al-Qaeda hotel. He saw himself as a poet, and he was a very kind of, had a flighty kind of imagination. He was not the smartest guy in the world, and he spoke in this kind of poetical way, and they didn't start to get anything from him, really, until they started to relate to those kinds of aspects of his personality. You know, the CIA tells the story, yeah, we waterboarded him, and he talked instantly. That's crap. And by the time you get to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which is a year later, in 2003, you know, they had all the stuff they needed to interrogate him without waterboarding. And furthermore, he's probably the most talkative person this side of Jay Leno. I mean, the guy loves to talk. Anytime he talked to a reporter, which was a couple of times, just blah, blah. He claimed everything. And, of course, eventually in his confession, he claimed everything except the crucifixion of Christ. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just... So you didn't have to waterboard this guy. He was waterboarded just because they wanted to waterboard him.
That one was revenge, you said.
You said vengeance.
Yeah. We're going to be back in a minute with Christopher Dickey so that we can continue this without me interrupting you. Mr. Dickey, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, be with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Christopher Dickey certainly lives there, breathes there, reports from there. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with you, Mr. Dickey.
The outer limits.
Well, what you say about New York, that the NYPD, the New York Police Department, not the public library, though also this, really put this, the diversity in the best sense of the word of New York to work. If you know anything about Arabs, Arabs like to talk. Where did we lose all of the, as Bill was saying earlier, the context and the granularity? These things are just intuitively obvious.
Well, they are obvious, but there's a whole sort of mindset in the United States government and in the media and in the sort of the message that's put out to the media to say, all these people are crazy. You can't deal with them. I'm not saying all Arabs, although there are some people who will tell you that. But they'll certainly say that anybody who's thinking about being a terrorist, who could talk to these people? They're obviously deranged. And there is a complete denial of any kind of cause and effect. If you mention cause and effect, a lot of people will talk to you and say, well, you're being an apologist for the terrorist. No, you're just trying to figure out what drives them, what makes them tick. And certainly at the level of the NYPD, trying to defend the world's number one terrorist target, New York City, they want to know what makes these guys tick. So they study them at every level. But mainly, they try and get close to the culture they come from.
If you're trying to prevent rather than react after the event, you have to get inside the heads of the people who are likely to commit these crimes.
Of course you do. Of course you do. You have to understand the sources of their anger, the sources of their personal problems. You have to look at the way they organize. And actually, the NYPD did a very controversial study that came out in summer of 2007 called Radicalization in the West, which was, I think, very badly presented to the public, and particularly to the Muslim communities of New York. But there are some really interesting lessons to be learned from it. One of the things that it did was they sent analysts from the intelligence division to all the places where there were what seemed to be homegrown terrorist plots to see how they happened and if there were any kind of patterns that you could see that were being replicated again and again. And I'm not saying that it would stand up to the most rigorous peer review in academia, but it does have a couple of insights that are extremely useful. And to me, the most important is that when you've got what they call a group of guys, just a parenthesis here, one of the things I love about the cops is that you don't get lost in definitions. It's like, what is terrorism? You never hear that discussion. This is about stopping the bad guys, right? So you have a group of guys who are getting increasingly radicalized. They're seeing stuff on the web or DVDs of atrocities by Christians against Muslims, by Israelis against Muslims. Some of the stuff is real, some of the stuff is totally doctored. A lot of it is grotesque to watch. And they are stoking their anger about Iraq, another subject. They're not dangerous when they go to the mosque. That's not the problem. The thing that the police are looking for is when they withdraw from the mosque. When all of a sudden they don't want to hear any more mainstream Muslim views, they don't want any equivocation by people who are saying Islam is the way of peace, not of violence, of which there's a lot of people. They don't want to hear that. So when you have a group of three or five or six guys that you all of a sudden see, the community sees, withdrawing like this, that's when you know you've got a problem. And that's where, from the NYPD's point of view, they want to move in.
Danny Colson, years ago, you probably know Danny Colson from way back.
He was at the FBI. And was number two at the FBI, and was at Ruby Ridge and some of those really dreadful mm-hmm. places.
Told us years ago, this was
long before
9/11, but it was after Timothy McVeigh, and he argued forcefully, and you actually open your book with this, the difference between a soldier and a policeman,
mm-hmm.
and he argued forcefully, looking principally at domestic terrorism, terrorists, that they, you know, if you treat them as criminals,
exactly,
rather than as soldiers or terrorists or all these other things, and just look at the crime and look at the, use the standard methodology, and he went on to say, by and large, crimes are solved because somebody tells you who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Not because you drop a nuke on them. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that that goes to the heart of why the New York Police Department, was successful in ways that the global war on terror, capital W, capital T.
The GWAT.
The GWAT.
What an unfortunate acronym.
He says contemptuously that one has been, by all accounts, very successful, and the other has been, by, I think, a reasonable analysis, an abysmal failure, and has been actually counterproductive, that being the GWAT. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that that's at the heart of what you're talking about, that a police department that had extraordinary resources, both economic but also in terms of people and the community of which they were part, have been able to succeed in ways that the federal government, particularly with huge resources, again, economic principle in this case, has not been successful.
Well, that's right. Look, the NYPD is huge for a municipal police department. It's enormous. It's about 35,000 cops. I think the city of Atlanta has 2,000 cops. I mean, you've got Fulton and Cobb County and then MARTA, and there's other cops floating around, but there's 35,000 cops in the NYPD, 17,000 civilians. It's almost a $4 billion annual budget. They've got a lot of resources, but compared to the federal government, they are lithe and nimble and lean, mm-hmm. and they are able to move much more quickly, and it also is very hierarchical in the sense that you've got the mayor, police commissioner, and then the commissioner's guys, Cohen, Falkenrath, these guys, and it goes like that. I was just meeting with some staffers on the Hill for the Department of Homeland Security Committee, the Republican side of it, and we were talking about this, and they were saying, yeah, look, the Department of Homeland Security, it's got about 535 bosses. It's got bosses everywhere you look, and everybody wants a piece of it and wants to do something with it. So the NYPD
that would be the House of Representatives and the Senate and the President.
Exactly. And so this is a much more nimble organization, and in fact, Kelly was able to turn it almost on a dime. You know, he came in and said, our mission is prevention. Now, by 2002, the FBI was saying the same thing. But its institutional culture was almost impossible to turn around, and still is very difficult to turn around.
Please say about the FBI's essential, the difference. I'm not going to say it because I want you to say it. The difference in the way that the FBI, that has lots and lots of lawyers who have become FBI agents.
Well, and let me just say, Kelly took issue with something I said the other day when he said, you know, we're not breaking the Constitution. You don't know how many lawyers we've got in the NYPD. They've got a lot of lawyers, but they don't have the culture, the legal culture or legalistic culture of the FBI. And the FBI was essentially created around the idea that you prosecuted cases, and that any evidence you gathered was essentially about gathering evidence for prosecution, and that the fact of prosecution would have its own deterrent effect. Now, if you're dealing with people who are going to blow themselves up, they don't really give a damn about the fact of prosecution. They're not going to be around for the trial. So you've got to get into that. You've got to penetrate that those networks much, much earlier. Now, I'm not saying that the FBI doesn't do that. It does. There was a case here in Atlanta a couple of years ago that was related to things all over the map, and it still hasn't come to trial. And that was an FBI case, essentially. But the NYPD said immediately, we're not about prosecuting. The intelligence division of the NYPD is the only part of the police that's exempted from the computer statistics program for which the NYPD is famous, where it's all about accountability, it's all about arrests, it's all about
cops on dots.
Intelligence division, they don't have CompStat. They're not part of that because nobody wants to hold them accountable for some kind of numbers game involving arrests. And when they arrest people, it's really to use the coercive power of the police to recruit informers. Around the intelligence division, I was amazed when I was there at one point and they were talking about getting people who sit on two seats at the same time. I said, what are you talking about? They said, look, when we've got somebody that we think is part of one of these groups of guys, maybe they've withdrawn from the mosque, it's people that we think are starting to get seriously dangerous, potentially, we'll follow one of them onto the subway. will send a uniform cop, a white shield, up to him, and he'll say, you know, it's illegal to sit on two seats at the same time in the subway of New York City. And the guy's, what? He says, yep, you're coming down to the station with us. Then you get him down to the station, and you say, you know, we know about you. We know about your friends. What are they going to think if we tell them you've been down here talking to us? And so you start this game of intimidation, cooperation, complicity, source building, and you basically recruit informers using the coercive power of the police. I'm not telling you that's a nice thing. It's not. But it's been used in the criminal world to fight crime for a long, long, long time. And it's something that the FBI really cannot do and the CIA really cannot do. Local cops can do it, and if they're as smart as the NYPD, they can do it effectively.
The difference between crime and terror is something I want to come back to in just a moment. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Christopher Dickey, please may you be with us too. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Christopher Dickey has graced us with his presence. We're talking about the world, as well as talking about New York. You have experience with terror all over the world. And I say terror, not terrorism. Terror, being terrified. On 9/11, I came upstairs and said, Bill, turn on the TV. Something really bad is happening. And we watched the second tower go down. And then he said, Paula, turn it off. I said, but, he said, we're not going to know anything for a long time. It's going to be a lot of noise, but we aren't going to know anything for the foreseeable future. Coming to securing the city and thinking about being terrified and what happens to us individually and culturally and the world when we are in a state of terror, isn't that part of what your story is how to get beyond being just frozen in terror so that you can begin to see what really happened?
Well, I think that's exactly right. But I also was amazed. I was in New York on 9/11, and I was stunned by the resilience of the New Yorkers. Their ability not to accept it, because I don't think anybody's forgotten it, not in New York City anyway, but to stand up straight and get on with their lives. It was really stunning. It was the most amazing thing. And there is tremendous strength in that, and if you don't undermine it by trying to make the fear artificial, by having red alerts and orange alerts anytime you're a bureaucrat and you want to cover your ass, then you have a tremendous strength of character in the community and in the city to work with, where people will instinctively try to make themselves feel safe. Now, I think the balance has to be one in which they're alert. The slogan on the subways in New York is, if you see something, say something. You definitely don't want people, you know, dragging a massive backpack or duffel bag onto the subway and then getting off at the next stop and everybody going, huh.
No.
You don't want that. But you do want, people to be alert enough so that they see things like that. But you don't want people looking over their shoulders all the time.
Well, you say that, and then you look at America post 9/11 and the world post 9/11 and what did happen. Please tell us about what happened in March of 2003 that you say was such an opportunity.
Well, I mean, I think what happened in March of 2003 is that basically we had won the war against the people who carried out 9/11. It's true that Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden were still off in the mountains someplace. But all the key architects and operatives of 9/11 and of other major attacks like the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, all of them had been captured. In fact, it's a credit to the CIA and to its organization that during that period of time, it was able to work with other intelligence services, keep the focus on what was needed, and to get these guys. And the invasion of Afghanistan was helpful in that. But that was an extremely limited military operation. And as of 2003, the Bush administration might have said, we've won, and we're going to keep after bin Laden, we're going to keep supporting the efforts to find him in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and now we're going to get on to the business with living our lives. But they didn't, of course. March 2003 was precisely the moment when the Bush administration decided it had to go to war with Iraq, which is actually something it had been planning to do since the end of 2001. And it was just a stunning mistake. It did nothing except create more hatred of America, broaden the pool from which terrorists draw their recruits, make it harder to get intelligence, and ultimately bog the United States down in a war that costs about $2.5 billion a week. And the sole purpose of spending that money is essentially to keep Americans in a country where they're not wanted.
It's easy to be skeptical and perhaps even cynical if someone believes in a unitary presidency, and if someone believes...
A unitary presidency? You're not thinking of Dick Cheney, are you?
As one example, yes. Part of the requirement, of course, is that that applies in the time of war, and if you can somehow construct an infinite war, then you get to have a unitary presidency pretty much forever. And I think there is a mindset that was not particularly interested in declaring victory and moving on to life as usual, that was really much more interested in this, and it had political benefits.
I think there's a tendency when we talk about those days to try and isolate one element or another and say this was the reason, unitary presidency or oil or... they really did think there was WMD or...
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah.
The problem was, precisely, that there were so many, from the Bush administration's point of view, so many good reasons to go into Iraq, that they ignored the one huge bad reason, which is that we were going to wind up occupying the country and having and creating more problems than we solved. They just couldn't see it. They would not, literally would not see it. This was the famous lesson with General Shinseki when he says it's going to take years and hundreds of thousands of troops.
What? They fired him.
They fired him. Goodbye. We don't want him around. We don't want that message getting out there because people might step back. You know, we don't want to go on and on about Iraq. It's a little bit far afield from the NYPD, but...
It's right in the heart of the NYPD.
But it's right in the heart of the problem that I wrote the book to try to address. Because it's obvious that invading and occupying countries is not a good way to solve the issue of terrorism. Look at Israel. See, 1967, so that's 32 years since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza. Huh. If invading and occupying were the solution to terrorism, there shouldn't be any problem there. I don't think we can say that.
Richard Ben Kramer wrote a book called How Israel Lost, and it is directly premised on when you become an occupier, you have changed the game and you lose.
Look, I don't know why American Southerners don't understand this. Because the American Southerners, we're sitting here in Atlanta, American Southerners ought to be the first people to understand this. When I was a little boy going to school here in Atlanta, it was 100 years after the Civil War, and we used to teach ourselves the words to a song called Good Old Rebel. You know this song, Good Old Rebel? I won't sing, I'll spare you the song, but the words are real important. The key verse is, it's all about the occupation of the South by the North. You know, and there's this great verse where it says, 300,000 Yankees is stiff in Southern dust. Yeah, we got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of Southern fever and Southern steel and shot. But I wish it was 3 million instead of what we got. Now, if that was the sentiment that was being shared among school children 100 years after the end of the Civil War, why on earth do we think that people who are occupied by powers that do not share their faith, that do not share their language, and do not share their culture are going to forget that? And this is one of the reasons that the Europeans, and the French particularly, were adamant when they were talking to the Americans about going into Iraq. Everybody in Europe, every country in Europe, has either been an occupier or been occupied or both within living memory. They all know what this is about and the kind of hatreds that it engenders. And the Bush administration, well, you know, Bush was a fake Southerner. He wouldn't know these things. But you know, they should understand. People should understand that that's what this is about. I'm not saying that this is the root of all evil, but it is a huge problem.
One of the things that I don't want to run out of time before talking about is when you talk about that 40% of New Yorkers who are born other places, that key element of that first generation of people who come to America, as compared to the second and third generation, seems to me to be a much bigger issue, and I sort of set this before we go away, that if, in fact, we were to live the American dream instead of just talk about it, you'd be addressing all kinds of roots of terror, not just among people born elsewhere.
I think there are lots of issues here that we could talk about even longer than we're going to go, but the American dream, the Protestant ethic, it's really an immigrant dream and an immigrant ethic. And it doesn't, there's nothing about it that has to be Protestant. You can be Hindu, you can be Muslim, you can be Jewish, you can be Catholic, you can be an atheist. When people come to the United States, they come to the United States to build their futures. They come because they buy into the dream. This is really the secret of security in New York City. And in fact, in most of the big cities in the United States, where there are high proportions of first-generation immigrants. The problem, I mean, in fact, if you look at the list of the top 10 safest cities, I think 8 of them are all heavy.
Starting with El Paso, which sits on the border.
They're right there in Juarez, but people in El Paso, they want to keep things quiet. When you look at that, you know, you start to understand that safety is about, it's about the way people feel in the society, about the possibilities it gives them. And if there's a problem with immigration, then there is. And you see this in L.A. It's when you have second and third generation children of immigrants who didn't come of their own free will. They're here, and they feel cut off from the possibilities of the society. Their parents may not have succeeded enough. They may be cut off for linguistic or cultural or racial reasons. But when you get that, then you start to see a reaction. But that's a slightly different issue.
We'll be back in just a moment with Christopher Dickey so that we can continue this conversation. Stay with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Christopher Dickey is with us. We're talking about a number of things that you have covered as a reporter as well as reporting to us in the book, Securing the City Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. Bill Russell?
Democracy is the worst form of government, except all the others. Part of, I think, the challenge, I mean, we grew up in roughly the same time. We sort of grew up being taught that little Southern exercise aside, that America had perfected democracy. And the problem with having perfected it is no longer dynamic. So I think we didn't understand that democracy was an ongoing struggle and that it has real challenges, not the least of which is when you're dealing with totalitarians, when you're dealing with violence. The rule of law is very important. Justice is a requirement for the rule of law to provide legitimacy. All of those things are very important lessons, and we ignored most of them. The GWAT flies
Global
in the face.
Global War on Terror, for those who are not using acronyms.
We just abandoned that wholesale. The administration led us, but we, by and large, as a people, For a time, you fought it. We tried in our own way. But by and large, the country, the Republicans, the Democrats, the great American electorate formed up and got in line and marched down that path saying, well, democracy, but not too much. Laws, but not for those people. Justice, but not, you know, but we can't let it get out of hand. That was a serious mistake.
Well, I think it was a serious mistake, although sometimes I think that the backlash against that goes too far, too. I mean, I think there was a kind of a false dichotomy for a while in discussing these issues where you had the military paradigm, and I think you understand I don't think that's a good idea, and then there was the law enforcement paradigm, as if that was the alternative. In fact, what's needed is a different kind of formation where you have the combination of law enforcement and intelligence gathering. That's how you fight terrorism. Because let's think about this for a minute. To have couched the actions of a handful of people in a framework of a war of civilizations, a clash of civilizations, is plainly nuts. This is not a clash of civilizations. These were a few testosterone-driven malcontents, some of whom were creative enough to figure out a way to hijack planes and blow up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
And some of whom had IQs of 78 and went along.
And a lot of them were at that level. It is stunning, the more you study terrorism, how many morons there are in the ranks of the terrorists. And also stunning that occasionally you will have a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or a Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker on 9/11, who really are brilliant and organized and obsessive and out to do what they want to do.
Which also sounds like the Unabomber when you're looking at domestic terror.
Of course. Of course. Why do we think that this is something unique to Muslims? It's something that's commonplace. There are a lot of nuts running around, and some of them have apocalyptic visions of themselves. You know, there's a whole riff in the book about the influence of Hollywood movies on these guys. Godzilla movies. Godzilla with Matthew Broderick here, but they were watching it in Afghanistan because they loved all that destruction.
And we're going to take out the Godzilla bridge, whichever one that is.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. So I think that the one of the things that the NYPD does and the Securing the City tries to focus on is the effort to keep it in perspective. Let's not talk about the worst thing that could happen. Let's talk about what does happen. Let's talk about the way terrorists actually do organize. If there was a fatal problem in the Bush administration, it's summed up in the word intentions. The Bush administration wanted to be judged by its intentions, not its actions. And in fighting terrorists, it judged them and their potential by their intentions, not their capabilities. And those two things fed off each other to give us a clash of civilizations and a global war on terror, when in fact we were talking about a relatively limited threat by a limited number of people who could be not easily neutralized, but could be neutralized by effective intelligence work, maybe some covert action, a lot of diplomacy, and by holding on to the American dream and making it clear that that's something that people can and should stand up for. And not only in this country, but outside the country.
When I was reading Securing the City, I kept thinking, because I didn't know you, I hadn't been following closely, and I kept thinking, where's police state in this? I kept pulling back thinking, and again, I did not come to this with preconceptions. I was trying to look at the story you were telling and how the police were being really effective, and I kept thinking, where's the line that this goes from police to police state, from city state to police state?
I think everybody who knows the situation in New York is concerned about that because this is really personality driven. People trust Ray Kelly. They trust David Cohen. Well, the FBI doesn't trust David Cohen, but people trust Ray Kelly, who's the man in charge, to know where that line is and not to cross it, or if he does cross it, to back up.
Well, but what if it's Dick Cheney you're talking about?
What if it's Bernie Kerik, the guy who was police commissioner before, who's now under indictment? I mean, there are a lot of things that could go very wrong with this paradigm.
Thank you, Mr. Giuliani.
Mr. Giuliani. Look, it's very worrisome. And I think, you know, as much as Kelly and Cohen talk about institutionalizing it and having it move forward, in fact, it's going to be very hard to do that. Now, there are some bright people who look at this and say, you know, we have to look at the intelligence law enforcement model and ways to develop that, not only at the New York City level, but in a more effective, in more effective ways at the national level.
And international level.
Well, and we're working with other countries. It is worrisome, and at the end of the day, you know, I'm asking that question at the end of the book. How far could you go with this? How do you stop it from being a police state? And because I think you guys have the background to bring this up, I'm not sure how many of your viewers or listeners do. In fact, if you look at what the NYPD does, it bears some resemblance to the old COINTELPRO program mm-hmm. during the 1960s and early 70s especially, that was used by the FBI in those days to eliminate the Weathermen and some other domestic terror groups and to intimidate a lot of people who were just pinkos. and dissidents.
And civil rights.
And civil rights. We all understand that there were a lot of abuses in COINTELPRO, but it was interesting that it also was very successful at preventing the Weathermen eventually from doing the kinds of things that they wanted to do. They just couldn't convict them in court later on. Which is exactly the position of the NYPD.
But they did violate an awful lot of civil liberties.
And there are a lot of people who will tell you that the NYPD does it, but they can't seem to prove it.
And there are a lot of people trying. This goes back hundreds, probably thousands of years. Who guards the guardians?
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, I mean, you raise it and come at it a lot of different ways, and it's a sub-theme. I mean, it comes back, not the least because there's so much conflict among the various alphabet soups with the police. And I found myself thinking that old child's game, rock, scissor, paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the way we design the government. Of the country, so that there was always somebody looking at somebody else, but it wasn't binary. Mm-hmm. There was and part of it is just you need responsible institutions that are separate from other responsible institutions, and the New York Police Department under the wrong people, given where they are today, unchecked, could do some really ugly things.
As could the federal government.
We all know the dangers, and it seems like this is just part of the dirty part, the hard part of democracy, is you got to keep, there have to be different institutions with the responsibility for checking on other institutions that have exceptional power. And we got to live with that.
We do, and I think that, one of the things I hope does not happen again is I wouldn't like to see the press abdicate its responsibility again the way it did, by and large, in 2002.
Cheerleaders.
It was really stunning to watch, especially if you were out in the field.
It was very disappointing, and particularly for a practitioner, I would think it had to be close to demoralizing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think if there's any nightmare that you have as a war correspondent or a journalist doing the kind of thing I do, and a lot of people do that sort of thing, it is to see a disaster on the horizon, see something really horrible coming at you, and to tell the world and have nobody listen.
Or not be able to get the voice out.
No, really, that's not the problem. The problem is that people don't listen. It's that you write one article, you do one television spot. Television was pretty shameless in 2002.
Prostitution comes to mind.
You do an article. Well, do you do another article that says the same thing the following week? Is that journalism, or are you adopting a cause?
And what would the cause have been?
Well, the cause would have been to try and stop the war. And I did my best in terms of writing this stuff, but it was overwhelmed. I think, Newsweek, I'm very proud of Newsweek. You can look at what we did on the web, and you can look at what we did in the print magazine. I did a long piece the week that Colin Powell testified, the title of which was The Perils of Victory. Basically laid out exactly what we've seen. Because this was not rocket science. This was not hard to figure out if you knew the region. And anybody in the State Department or the CIA or the military who knew the region understood that these problems were staring us in the face. But you get overwhelmed. You just get overwhelmed. But that's the nightmare. And it happened to, it's happened many times through history. Journalists who were covering Rwanda in the 90s, they saw it coming.
We see coming a quick break as we come back in a moment with Christopher Dickey. Be with us. We are delighted to be with Christopher Dickey, who has come to us because he's written a book called Securing the City, talking about the counter-terror force in New York with the police department. I was really amazed, and after you had come to press with this book, at the inauguration of Barack Obama, where 2 million-plus people came together on one day in one place. And I am told, during the course of that day, there were no arrests.
Mm.
There might have been a few pockets picked, but and then people went home. Now that's not just prevention.
Mm-mm. No, that has to do with the spirit of the country. I mean, you don't want to sound kind of airy-fairy talking about this, because you've got bad guys with guns and bombs and doing all kinds of crazy stuff out there. But the truth is, the best thing you've got going for you is the community that rejects those kinds of actions. And, you know, in telling the history of terrorism in New York, there are a lot of examples before 9/11, too. There was one very conspicuous one when 1997, where two Palestinians decided they were going to blow themselves up on the B train under the East River, and they were living in a shack on Park Slope in Brooklyn, and they had a couple of flatmates. And one of them was a young Egyptian guy who had won the lottery for a green card. And all he wanted to do was build his future in America. They showed him the bomb, and he went out on the street looking for a cop. It took him 7 or 8 hours trying to convince the police there was a problem here.
And his English was...
Because he didn't speak English. All he could say was, bomba, bomba. And there were problems finding translators. A lot of things that would not happen now.
And the cop he did find was a transit cop, and he did.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a great story. I didn't know how much time I had to go into it, but the bottom line is, he believed in the dream, and he did not want to be implicated in this act of terror, and he stopped it from happening. And if he had not done what he did, then those two guys, one of them would have blown himself up, and when the rescue workers came, the second one would have blown himself up, and you would have had a situation. It was a hell of a lot more grotesque and bloody and horrible than even what happened in London in 2005.
I'm struck by your, and it comes up time and again, the character of the New Yorkers is that, you know, basically they can take a punch. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's part of the lesson. We're going to get hit. The question is, are we going to collapse? Do we have glass jaws? Are we going to react manically, frantically, stupidly?
And we're not somehow exempt from getting hit.
Or are we going to take a punch and keep moving forward, doing whatever is possible to prevent that, but knowing that it's not written anywhere that we're not going to get punched?
No, that's right. I mean, I think that New York could sustain a lot of terrorist attacks and still keep going, as indeed London did, Paris did.
Madrid did.
It obviously couldn't sustain a nuclear attack, but you know, I think that is well. Actually, it probably could eventually.
It would.
But the emphasis on these weapons of mass destruction scenarios, that's really fear mongering. The police and the federal government, they need to worry about this. They need to focus on it. They need to have detection devices. But the truth is, no terrorist organization has ever come close to obtaining real weapons of mass destruction.
Well, you're talking about these cities. We fail to say Jerusalem. We fail to say Gaza. We fail to say the places in the Middle East that have just been pummeled for centuries, mm-hmm. millennia, that people do live their lives. We did a show within the last week with the former United States ambassador to Israel, who was saying, until we really get serious and are less innocent abroad, as he calls his book, that we really cannot reasonably deal with this kind of issue, that we have to be out in the world, we have to be using diplomacy, we have to be engaged with people, we have to get off our high horse. He didn't say that, I say that.
Well, he's right about that, but you also have to understand the way people's minds work in very fundamental ways. And one of the things that I think I think Martin understands this very well, but I think too often people fail to understand the impact of humiliation on a society. If you're humiliated enough, what do? You give up, you roll over, you say, yeah, humiliate me again? No, if you can get your own back, sometimes by doing really stupid things, you'll do it. That's just the way guys are.
It's sort of that song you used to sing when you were going to school in Atlanta, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very much like that. It's very much like that.
Come back when we can talk about something that's at least this much fun and maybe a lot more fun. Democracy is always a work in progress, and you've shown some interesting lights on some pretty dark places that we need to look at. Thank you very much indeed.
Christopher Dickey's book, Securing the City, reads a lot like a police thriller, and it reminds us both of what makes the United States powerful and what protects us best, the American promise of liberty and justice for all. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.